This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Another member of Cincinnati City Council indicted on a criminal charge, the fourth member facing legal troubles over the past 15 months. This time it's Wendell Young. WVXU reporter Becca Costello joins us via Zoom to start the weekly news review. Talk about that and other goings-on at City Hall. Becca, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, it's another week and another set of legal troubles facing a member of Cincinnati City Council, this time Wendell Young, as I said. What's going on here?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the fourth council member on current council to be indicted for criminal charges. It is important to note that this is kind of a unique circumstance. It's not related to the other three indictments. Those were involving development deals and potentially accepting bribes in exchange for positive votes on those. Instead, this is related to what our listeners have heard about many times, the Gang of Five text messaging case, which started in 2018 with five council members. So this idea being that the investigation investigation has been going on for a long time, and now finally just one member, Council Member Young, has been indicted on one count of tampering with records. And this is related to the fact that Young deleted some of the text messages that are considered public record because it involved a majority of council in this group text. Now, Council Member Young says he did delete the messages, but it was after he had turned them into the solicitor's office and before a court order that said that they were not supposed to delete anything. So he says there was no tampering or at least intentional tampering with evidence involved and that it was just a misunderstanding.
So this is a special prosecutor, right? Appointed by Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters.
That's right. Special Prosecutor Patrick Hanley, he's been working on this particular case since December 2019. And there were some questions about why, a year and a half or so later that the investigation was ongoing. He has told us that this will be the end of it. He's not expecting any further investigation or any further indictments.
That's something that he had said previously, I understand. Well, not necessarily that he wasn't bringing any indictments, but that in September of last year, Henley said that he wasn't bringing charges against any of the Gang of Five members, but that the investigation was ongoing.
That's correct.
Let's just remind our listeners that the so-called Gang of Five, which, by the way, was a nickname that emerged from the text messages between these five members of council. At the time, it was council members Tamaya Dennard, Greg Landsman, Chris Seelbach, P.G. Sittenfeld, and Wendell Young. Tamaya Dennard was ultimately charged in another situation and is no longer a member of council. She's been sentenced to prison. And P.G. Sittenfeld now facing a federal indictment on an unrelated situation as well. So what is next for what we're watching for here? I understand some members of council perhaps have called for a resignation.
That's right. So far, two members of council have called for Wendell Young to resign. Two Republicans, Betsy Sunderman and interim council member Liz Keating, have both asked him to step down. If he does resign his seat, then the person to select his replacement will actually be Chris Seelbach, because that is the person that Young has designated as the person to fill that vacancy if he leaves. However, in the case of some of the most recent indictments, Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld, who we've mentioned, rather than resigning, they accepted a suspension. So if that's the way that this turns out with Council Member Young as well, in that case, it wouldn't be considered a vacancy. And instead of Seelbach choosing the replacement, it would be an appointment from Hamilton County Probate Court Judge Winkler, who would appoint that replacement. He's also the one who appointed the replacements for both the Pastor and Sittenfeld cases.
Well, we'll continue to follow this case involving Councilmember Wendell Young, of course, at WVXU.org and right here on 91.7 FM. Interestingly, though, there is something coming up on the May ballot for Cincinnati voters that involves such designees. You reference Councilman Chris Seelbach being the one who would choose a replacement for Councilman Young should he decide to depart before the end of his term. Talk a little bit about what's on the ballot as it relates to what we've seen develop in city council over the past many months.
So two issues on the ballot, issues one and two, both deal with those successor designees that we mentioned. They would prevent a council member from changing their successor designee after being indicted on charges related to their work on council. So that would apply in this case that Wendell Young would be prohibited from changing his successor designee from Seelbach to another council member. They also deal with some other issues related to suspending a council member. And those are things that it's my understanding Cincinnati Edition will go into some depth on Monday's show.
It is indeed something we will be exploring a little more fully on Monday's show. We'll be talking to members of council, Betsy Sunderman and Chris Smitherman. I believe we're working that out still, but that is what we expect to have on Monday's show. We also know that the city is expecting an infusion of cash from the federal government as part of the American Rescue Plan Act. We're talking about $290 million. And we know that Mayor Cranley has some ideas on how to spend it. City Manager Paula Boggs-Muthing also has some ideas for that. It will go through City Council for approval. What do we know about the status of that money?
Well, there's a second public hearing for residents to weigh in on how they think the money should be spent, and that will be on Monday starting at 1 p.m. And that public hearing is happening in the Budget and Finance Committee meeting. But also, interestingly, at that meeting, Mayor Cranley, as we mentioned, has sort of his plan along with the city manager for how the money should be spent. Has gotten some criticism for introducing such a detailed plan for spending the money without getting any public input or input from council members. But there are four ordinances from Mayor Cranley's office related to that spending plan. $7 million for performing arts support grants, $1 million for an outdoor dining grant program, $4 million for restaurant grants, and $2 million for outdoor dining and pedestrian safety improvements. So these are all, you know, somewhat minor parts of the overall plan from the city administration, but he has gone ahead and introduced those as ordinances. Now, I talked to the chair of the committee, David Mann, this morning. He said that they do not plan to take a vote on those ordinances on Monday. He says it seems too soon to make any official decisions about spending the money because they are still collecting public feedback.
We're talking with WVXU reporter Becca Costello here on Cincinnati Edition's Weekly News Review. I want to talk a little bit more about some money that the city could be spending if voters decide on that. We briefly addressed issues one and two that will be appearing on the primary ballot this May for Cincinnati voters. There's also a third possible charter amendment on the May ballot. And this is one we talked about on this program. It's related to the Affordable Housing Trust. So talk to us a little bit about what you reported as it relates to this week.
Yeah, so this is the issue three, and as you mentioned, it's one that I think has gotten a lot more attention compared to issues one and two. This is the Affordable Housing Charter Amendment that would require the city to put at least $50 million a year into an Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and because it's a charter amendment, it would be a permanent change that could only be altered through another charter amendment on a future ballot. And so there's city officials have come out strongly against this amendment, saying that it would really decimate the budget and cause lots of layoffs. On the other hand, proponents say that the city is just sort of engaged in fear mongering, that they're saying, they want folks to vote against the amendment. And so they're threatening the alteration of public services that they think will get people to vote against it. Interestingly, some reporting from Howard Wilkinson this week looks at sort of the big money behind some of the opponents to this measure and actually kind of enemies coming together on this. So two political consulting firms, one Democratic and one Republican, are working together to kind of oppose this amendment. They're the folks behind some of the mailers that some of our listeners may have gotten. They're kind of funding this No on Issue 3 campaign. So there's really a pretty well-organized and well-funded push to get voters to vote against it. And so we're seeing that not just out of City Hall, but also from kind of top political leaders in the community as well.
Becca, you mentioned that a lot of city leaders have come out against the proposed charter amendment that would require $50 million of the city's revenues or the city's money every single year in support of affordable housing. They say that this would decimate the budget. And you also heard from public sector unions within the city concerned about the impact on first responders, for example, public works and that sort of thing. But it's not that the city and its officials don't want to see more affordable housing. We have heard them say that they do want more affordable housing, just in a different way. And you reported this week that city officials will apply for $34 million to establish what they're calling an affordable housing loan pool. What is that?
That's right. And this is a funding that would come from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And as a loan pool, it's what they call a rotating fund. So basically, it would be funding that it gives is granted to developers in the form of low interest loans, who would it's aimed to incentivize them to build or rehabilitate affordable housing in the city. And then when that money gets paid back into the fund, it can be reinvested again as a loan to another developer. So again, a rotating fund that would ideally be kind of continually investing in housing in the community. Now, you mentioned that, you know, city officials are saying we do want affordable housing. When it comes to sort of opposing this issue three, I think there's definitely some push to for the city to take some new action before the May election in order to kind of show people, see, we are taking action on this. Here are some things that we're doing. And so there, this is just one of, I think, a few actions we'll see from City Hall on affordable housing over the next couple weeks. That being said, I think because there's a little bit of a rush on this, there's not always a lot of details about some of these programs. And so there are still some questions that we're not sure about. And hopefully we'll get those answers soon.
But it sounds like this would have a separate advisory board that would be appointed by the mayor.
That's right. Although the advisory board would not only manage the loan pool using the $34 million from HUD, it would also manage the existing Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Now, that's something that the issue three is looking to establish a trust fund. The city does currently have one. It only has about $1.5 million. So this board that would be appointed by the mayor would oversee both of those programs. And maybe more importantly, would establish priorities for city policy concerning what the city should be doing to increase and preserve affordable housing. Like many advisory boards, those would be priorities only, so recommendations, sort of best practices. But there would be no obligation on behalf of city officials or anyone else to necessarily follow those priorities.
Well, let's just reiterate something that we talked about moments ago, the American Rescue Plan, where the city is expecting $290 million. There is a public hearing on Monday at 1 o'clock, and there is virtual participation available, but City Hall is partially reopening, right?
That's right. This is a limited reopening starting on Monday. So City Hall has been closed to the public over the last several months because of the pandemic. Right now, it's opening to the public only for City Council and Council Committee meetings. But even though people can show up and participate in public comment in person again, the virtual participation will continue at least for the time being. So there's no real clarity on if there's going to be a permanent virtual participation, although a couple of council members have introduced a motion asking the city administration to look into making that permanent. Now, that would require some changes on the state level as well that would be outside of city administration control. But there are at least some people in city council hoping to keep that as an option for residents, because it can be quite a bit easier to participate virtually compared to coming all the way downtown.
That's WVXU reporter Becca Costello. You can read her reporting at WVXU.org, in addition to hearing it right here on our air on 91.7 FM. Becca, thanks so much for the time you gave us today.
Thanks, Michael.
And we've been reporting on corruption at Cincinnati City Hall. And now, beginning this Monday, April 19, we launch Trust in Local Government, WVXU's Public Integrity Project. The WVXU newsroom will bring you a close examination of Cincinnati politics, the primary election, corruption, and accountability. You can look for that starting Monday. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Wes Miller was announced this week as the new head coach of the Cincinnati Bearcats men's basketball program. His predecessor, John Brannon, was fired following the departure of multiple players and investigations launched by the university. And we still don't seem to know all the circumstances leading to UC kicking Brannon out after just two seasons. We will talk just ahead about the way the university handled that. But first, I spoke earlier this morning with the Athletic Cincinnati reporter Justin Williams about Wes Miller and UC basketball. Here's our pre-recorded conversation. Justin Williams is a reporter with the Athletic in Cincinnati. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
It's been a whirlwind couple of weeks for Cincinnati Bearcats fans, a swift departure of two-year head coach John Brannon, and then the announcement of Wes Miller, who was introduced this morning at a press conference. I'll note for our listeners that Justin and I are talking before that press conference took place this morning, but you know all about it already. So let's just start with who the new face is. This is Wes Miller. He comes from UNC Greensboro. How did he land in Clifton?
Yeah, so he's a basketball lifer, and in a lot of ways a North Carolina lifer. He was born in Greensboro. He played for 3 years in college at the University of North Carolina for the Tar Heels, played under Roy Williams there. And then, you know, I think had like 1 year of a kind of a professional career and went straight into coaching. And he actually was an assistant at UNC Greensboro, and then moved into an interim coaching position when the head coach got fired at 28 years old. And he then was there for 10 years after that. So he was the youngest Division I head coach at the time when he was officially hired. And, you know, kind of the unique thing about him is there's probably no one else in the sport who can claim to be kind of that young, under 40 up and comer, but also have 10 years of Division I head coaching experience. And honestly, I think that had a huge impact on him getting hired at Cincinnati because, you know, the situation he's walking into is not necessarily an easy one. You're kind of having to rebuild the roster after John Brandon was fired. You're having to rebuild the culture, you know, trying to get back a very storied, proud program and fan base to kind of the level of success they're used to. And I think that would be a really tough ask for someone who's a young head coach or, you know, maybe an assistant moving into a head coaching job for their first, you know, first major job. And so with Wes Miller, you get someone who's proven, you know, to be a successful winning head coach, but also still kind of has that like young, hungry, you know, persona about him. And from all indications, the University of Cincinnati cast a pretty wide net, did an extensive search with this and landed on Wes Miller being the guy, despite honestly having, you know, really no ties or history in Cincinnati or with the program.
He must have done an impressive amount of work in Greensboro because I'm looking at his head coaching record. He's been there for about 10 seasons. And the first half of that tenure, we're pretty much losing records in Greensboro, but he really turned it around. They've won more than, I think, 20 games for the past five seasons. And taking a program that had been apparently in shambles in Greensboro and making a couple of appearances in the NCAA tournament. And we should note that he did play at North Carolina and was on a championship team there. So he is familiar with championship basketball. What can we expect his adjustment is that he has to make to Cincinnati, which isn't in the best of conditions right now, but does have a fan base that still demands it compete for Final Four appearances?
Yeah, and, you know, I think he has a couple things working for him. One is what you said, you know, he made a turnaround at UNC Greensboro, but it was not immediate. You know, he came in and changed some things early on, but it took a few years for him to kind of get that program moving in the right direction. And he's talked about this in the past, that they really afforded him the time to do that. And he was a very young guy. He was a local guy. I'm sure he, you know, that kind of was working for him. They were maybe a little more patient than they would have been with other people. But I think he probably learned a lot from that experience. And again, that goes back to when he's walking into this now, maybe there are some of those, you know, early just missteps or learning curves that, you know, young first-time head coaches have that he won't necessarily have in this position. And I think that's going to serve him really well. And then, you know, the other thing is, and this kind of came up throughout the whole hiring process is, You know this, Cincinnati is a very provincial town, and they kind of wrap their arms around their own. And, you know, there was a big push to get Eric Martin, who was a former player and has been an assistant under Bob Huggins at West Virginia for a long time, to get him this job. And so I think one of the things Wes Miller is going to have to do is he's going to have to, you know, put his own imprint and kind of his own style on this program while finding ways to embrace the past and kind of weave the history of the program into his style and his, you know, his coaching tenure. He's already done that a little bit. Apparently he had a Zoom with some former players last night already. And, you know, I think one thing that benefits him there is you mentioned him playing at Carolina, very similar to Cincinnati and probably even more so. Carolina basketball is a family. And, you know, he understands that idea of being part of a program that is kind of like a family history program. And so while he doesn't have that experience with Cincinnati, he understands that concept, and I think that will probably serve him well coming over here.
I wonder what the fan base must feel like right now because, you know, the Huggins days are long behind us at this point. Mick Cronin had some success there, maybe not in March, but some winning seasons, and obviously went to the Final Four this year as head coach at UCLA after leaving UC, and they had a rough time with John Brannon, whom they snatched from NKU. So, I mean, what condition is the fan base in right now? Are they hoping for some stability? Do they expect some long-term success from this new man?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. You mentioned kind of the Bob Huggins, it's a long time ago, but, you know, with this program, the past is never far behind. Bob Huggins still has an incredible amount of sway on this program. And Mick Cronin does too. And John Brandon, while he wasn't necessarily a part of kind of that Bob Huggins coaching tree, he was a local guy. And so I think with the fan base, there might be some little trepidation of, oh, you know, if Wes Miller is going to come in and he is successful, well, then he has no ties that will keep him here. He's just going to move on. To me, that's like a great problem to have, because if you have someone coming in and kind of being upward mobile and having success and then maybe moving on to a quote-unquote bigger, better job, that means they've had to have had some success here. So that to me seems like, well, you deal with that problem when you get to it, and if it is, you know, something that's a reality, that means that there's going to be plenty of people wanting to come in and take that job after him. So there might be a little trepidation that there are no ties, there's no kind of history here. But to me, that's just like you're worrying about the wrong things, and you're worrying about something that if you get there, it might actually kind of be a blessing in some ways.
Well, let's talk about John Brandon. He is a local guy. He's from Campbell County and had some serious assistant coaching positions around the country and landed at NKU for four seasons. In their first year of eligibility, took them to the NCAA tournament, took them there twice, also played in the NIT. Just a great success for the Norse, and came over to Cincinnati, I think, with some lofty expectations. But what went wrong?
Yeah, you know, I think when he was hired, it was kind of seen as like this way to push the program in kind of a new, more modern direction in terms of how they played on the court. But you also got that he's a local guy. He grew up in Northern Kentucky. He understands the history of the program and the city. So it honestly seemed like a perfect fit at first. And I think just that transition was more difficult than people expected. He was kind of brought in to like get the team over the hump in March that you referenced, that Mick Cronin seemed to struggle with at times. And instead, I think we realized even getting to the precipice of that hump is actually a very difficult thing. And, you know, he was making some transitions to the culture and the roster and the style of play. And, you know, the truth is he might have actually been successful and been able to get there, but he didn't get that chance because after this season ended, there was just a flood, a mass roster exodus of players entering the transfer portal, and clearly some cultural issues within the team and within the locker room that really fractured the program and kind of a lack of trust with Brandon. And, you know, yeah, if you've been following the story, it kind of started really quickly and then seemed to drag on. But from my perspective, even covering the team all year, it was not certainly something that I saw coming this offseason, to think that a month after the season ended, they'd be firing John Brandon for cause.
And do we really know the full picture yet of what went down between John Brandon and UC and the athletics department?
We certainly don't necessarily know it from the university's perspective. So, you know, I've written a lot about this, and certainly others have reported on it as well. There was a clear rift between a number of players on the team and with John Brandon. A lot of them entered the transfer portal. They also had, you know, a strength coach leave the program after his first season. So it was something that, it, you know, kind of extended from roster to staff. And there were very clear issues based on my reporting. Now, what we don't totally know is the University of Cincinnati conducted an internal investigation, an external investigation, and, you know, ultimately put him on suspension and then relieved him of his duties. So, you know, kind of, I guess from my perspective, like what I know is the stuff that I've reported and put out there. What I don't know is, does the university know more than that? Was there, you know, something that they felt, you know, was egregious enough that deserved to be fired for cause? It's kind of hard to say what their perspective was without them speaking on it. And I realize for legal reasons why they don't want to or can't or won't. But you're right. You know, I think we know some of the issues that were going on. What we don't totally know is how and why was the decision made that those issues merited John Brandon being fired for cause.
Justin Williams is a reporter with The Athletic in Cincinnati. Justin, thank you so much for the time you gave us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate having me.
And you are listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Excuse me, Michael Monks, joined now live on the phone by Jason Williams, a columnist at the Cincinnati Inquirer, also co-host of the That's So Cincinnati podcast with our good friend Sharon Coolidge. Jason, you didn't mince words in your analysis about the way the University of Cincinnati handled the unceremonious departure of men's basketball head coach John Brandon. You referred to it as the UC way. Tell us what the UC way is to you.
Well, thanks for having me back, Michael. It's great to talk with you today and your listeners. And the UC way is a way of secrecy and lack of transparency. And it's honestly, it's been like that for a long time. And it's interesting, after I write that, you start to hear even more stories about just like, hey, how difficult they are. And I've heard from people who have dealt with, things on the medical side as well, who have just really had issues with, and clearly, when you get into HIPAA, and that's a different thing. But I'm mainly talking about, I came at this as a government watchdog and not as a sports fan or not from the sports perspective, but UC has a long history of, they're very difficult to deal with on a legal side of things with public records. They're very difficult to deal with from the public relations standpoint. And I'm not just talking about, when it comes to tough questions or controversial issues. There are times when the university doesn't even respond to real basic media inquiries, even on positive stories or, not positive or negative, just, general basic stories that you're going to ask or write about a university that's 44,000 students and 7,500 employees. And I'm talking about just the main campus and, 300 some thousand living alumni across the world. UC is, and I know your listeners know this, but they're a great asset to this university. But the secrecy and the lack of really wanting to be open with the public, I think, really isolates them from this community more so than what needs to happen.
And it is a public institution, we should note, and oftentimes, because it is a major athletics program as well nationally, the head coaches of the more significant sports programs there, like basketball, like football, are highly compensated. So John Brannon was being paid a lot of money, and he may still be paid a lot of money from the university as part of his departure. So I want to talk specifically about the John Brannon situation, then we'll dive into a little bit about some other instances you have some issues with the university and the column that you wrote about the UC way, as you framed it. John Brannon was fired in what you refer to as a Friday afternoon news dump, and we still don't know a whole lot about why.
Yeah. No, we don't. And I heard Justin Williams on with you earlier there, and he's a great reporter, and he's really done a lot of nice work on the story. And I from my sources in and around the university, I've heard things. I don't think it's responsible for me to share what those rumors are. Other than I can say this, I've not heard anything that's been so alarming. And again, these are just people, sources talking behind the scenes. There's been nothing that I've heard that's been alarming to the point where it's like, oh, wow. And again, that's just what I've heard. We don't know, but you're exactly right. We don't know. And I think the frustrating part of it is if you're coming at this, again, viewing University of Cincinnati as a massive public money, taxpayer-funded institution, and clearly they get a lot of private money as well, but a $1.4 billion annual operating budget, over $1 billion endowment. And again, so much interest publicly and privately in that university. And for the university not even to just generally say, and there's nothing legally that precludes them from doing this, is that they can't, they really should at least just say, here's the general reason of our investigation. And there's nothing that legally precludes them then from after the investigation being over and them firing John Brannon for them saying, generally speaking, here's why John Brannon was fired, period. And then I know there's litigation from John Brannon, and let the rest of that play out in court. But they're not even doing that. And it goes back to what I was referencing in the column last week in the UC way, and it's just another sort of item on a long list of secrecy and lack of transparency.
You note another instance involving the Enquirer and the university and the university's athletics program. We know that in the NCAA's conference realignment, UC was part of what was a much larger Big East with a lot of powerhouse athletic programs. When that kind of got mixed up and some programs moved to the ACC or other conferences, UC was kind of left out, but they were trying to get into the Big 12. You note that you couldn't get any records related to emails or other public records. The lead reporter from the Enquirer could not access those records, that the university was quite difficult to deal with.
Yes. Yeah. And I went on loan. I was, I went on loan from the news department to sports to cover that story. So I have intimate knowledge of that story because I was the lead reporter on it. And my editors trusted me to go for it and dive into the public records and then my sourcing. And I tell you, I heard for many years, and I went to the University of Cincinnati and worked for the student paper back in the mid-90s. And so I'd seen it up close as well. But, you know, for many years, you heard a lot of stories about that the university is just generally difficult to deal with from a media standpoint. And, you know, that was really my kind of real big firsthand, you know, view of that. I can't remember what I also was one of the lead reporters on the immediate aftermath of the Ray Tensing issue. I can't remember. I think that was before. So those were my first two big stories. And
Ray Tensing being the just as a reminder, Ray Tensing, the University of Cincinnati officer who shot and killed Samuel DeBose.
Yes, correct. And that was in 2015. I think the Big 12 thing may have been going on in...
Your column says later that year, so it was either 2015.
Yeah, that's right. It was later that year. So anyway, but it was a fight over records that was, again, this was a positive story, really, the university's attempts to try to get into a Power 5 conference. And there was absolutely no reason... Again, this is not a controversial story even. There's no reason for the university to have withheld records for 4 months and emails between, at the time, the president, Santa Ono, and other presidents at the Big 12 Conference. I remember at the time, David Bourne was the president of the University of Oklahoma, who was really the power player, power broker, so to speak, of the Big 12 Conference at the time. And you know, there was really no reason at all for them to withhold those records, and I there's a sense of, you know, that it almost feels personal, and I'm just saying it feels that way. It's like, and from our standpoint, our job at, you know, WVXU and the Cincinnati Inquirer and the TV stations and the media in general is to be there and to be the messenger for the public and watchdog public institutions and pursue public records, because those are not the university's records. Those are the public's records. And that's our job, to go pursue those and for those to come out and show the public, hey, here's what your publicly funded officials are doing on this topic. And I just remember it was incredibly frustrating. And it was, you know, you don't take it personal because it's not personal. But you do get frustrated from the standpoint for the public's sake. And again, it was 4 months of fighting. And finally, our attorney, the best First Amendment attorney in America, Jack Reiner, threatened a lawsuit if the university didn't release those records. And the university immediately released the records 4 months after I put in my first initial public records request.
All right, Jason, well, before we let you run to get on with your weekend, just back to this John Brannon UC situation. I don't think we've heard the last of it. I think ultimately we will learn some stuff. What are you looking for? What do you think the university is waiting for? What will you be looking for as a way to either smooth this out or just move on from it?
Well, I've had a few conversations this week, and I think now the university is anticipating litigation between John Brannon and the university. And so I think this is going to be months, potentially maybe even years, if this thing drags out, maybe not years, but potentially over a year. And it's going to be a long time. I don't think I'm going out on a limb and saying it's going to be a long time before the public knows what happened there.
Jason Williams is a columnist at the Cincinnati Inquirer and the co-host of the That's So Cincinnati podcast hosted at the Inquirer. Jason, thanks for spending some time with us today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Michael, and have a great weekend.
You too. Up next, we'll take a look at local health care in the post-pandemic world. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We finish our weekly news review now with Inquirer reporter Ann Saker. Ann, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so very much for inviting me again, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Well, we're always appreciative of the time you give us after all of your outstanding reporting with another week of such. And you and a couple of colleagues over at the Inquirer, Betty Lynn Fisher and Max Philby, kind of did a do's and don'ts on what to do after your 2 weeks have passed following either your first dose of one of the single dose vaccines or your second dose of one of the two dose vaccines. I'm in that boat right now. So like I just got my second dose this week and this column is perfectly timed because I'm wondering, well, what can I do? What can I do? And this is something you all looked at. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. The first thing you, the first don't I should say is don't take off your mask. We are still at a very high level of COVID in the community, as the public health officials say. So we need to continue wearing masks, as hard as that's going to be. Even though you are fully immunized, you can still pass it. And so we need to keep a lid on that as well. You can have parties out of doors. You can have, if all the parties are fully vaccinated and fully immunized, you can have a party indoors, but you need to limit it to 10 people. You can have your children's birthday party outside. You can go to indoor restaurants and movie theaters as long as you remain socially distant and wear a mask. So in effect, Michael, we do what we've been doing for a year, except this time we have the chemical assist of the vaccine. And that will be what's going to protect us to the point when the pandemic eventually does roll off.
And what we're waiting for, and obviously it's been so hard to wait because we've been going through this now for more than a year, but the vaccines are here. But the vaccines are so new, and we don't know all of the details about the way that the virus might be transmitted between people who are vaccinated. And we have seen some cases of people who are vaccinated, very, very limited, but it's happened. So what do we know about a timeline, if anything? I know you spend a lot of time talking to healthcare professionals and paying attention to what federal officials are saying as it relates to this pandemic. We are still wearing our masks, but is there any like sunset clause on that you've seen?
Unfortunately, this is not a baseball game or a football game or a 10K race. It's very difficult to pin an end, whatever we define as an end, and I think a lot of people define an ending as the day that we wish for where we can all pretend this never happened or that it's safely in the past and it no longer poses a threat. However, we do have the President of the United States saying that if we continue on this pace with vaccinations and people continue to practice all the public health measures, by the 4th of July, the president has said we can probably gather in family groups outside and masks indoors. But I think we could, if we can stay on this track, we can probably start seeing maybe later in the summer where we will have some social restrictions lifted. Now, unfortunately, I just read a story this morning. There's a new estimate out from University of California that's predicting a really grim winter coming up. So that we may well have another pretty significant surge, not because we're not doing anything, you know, bad, but because that's often how viral pandemics operate. And we are going to have pockets in this country that are resistant to getting the virus, and that is going to leave reservoirs of opportunity. And so we need to think about in those terms.
And that's the key. I mean, pandemic does mean global in a lot of ways of how far it has spread.
It does.
And there are places that are not doing well right now.
That's right. And I've spoken frequently with Dr. Fagan, who is the medical director at our Hamilton County Public Health Department. And he has said herd means the whole herd. So if we're talking about achieving herd immunity, we can't just talk about Cincinnati. We can't just talk about Hamilton County. We can't even just talk about the United States. Herd means the herd, all of us in the species. And when you look at it that way, herd immunity is a very distant goal. But we could achieve it in places like in Cincinnati or Hamilton County or in Ohio, where we're going to have pockets of really good immunity. And then we're going to have pockets where it might be 40%. And that is going to be the reality we're going to live through for the next probably in a couple of years.
So you're able to have a little bit more comfort while you're out there, but you must remain vigilant.
I think we do. And it is that vigilance that's the most important weapon as we're seeing through this, is that I know it's so hard. I'm itching. I am fully immunized as of Wednesday.
Nice.
I'm itching to go to a restaurant indoors and have a beautiful meal in one of our many excellent restaurants here. But, you know, last week I actually stopped in a place to pick up a hamburger and it felt strange. And this is a place that has been to the letter with the sanitation and public health restrictions. And there were people in the place, but it felt very strange. And that may be the biggest hurdle of all for restaurants, is inviting people to come back and you can feel safe here. I mean, the hospitals are having that problem.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about next. I mean, you had a story about changes we're going to see in local healthcare and in the post-pandemic world. We should note that we're not quite there yet, but hospitals want you to come back now.
I suspect you're going to see a lot of advertising everywhere in the next coming months from all of our hospital systems saying, come back, it's safe, don't defer your care. It's dangerous for you to defer your care. And we're clean and we can take you. We can be sanitary. But right now, all the hospital systems have told me that services have just not come back to the levels they saw before the shutdown in March, April, and to the 1st of May last year.
And one of those services, obviously, is preventive measures, right? People who used to go in for screenings about ailments they may face, and those have fallen off.
Lung cancer screenings, breast cancer screenings in particular, those are the two big killers in our region here, cancer killers. And UC Health has told me that it's off 40% from a comparable period. So it's really important for people to, I know it's hard because we are trying to navigate what's safe to do and what isn't safe to do. I can promise you that going to see your doctor because you've had chest pain or hand pain is much more important than getting into a restaurant for a meal. So go do that first.
Certainly. Well, one thing that we have adjusted to during the pandemic as it relates to our doctors is when we weren't necessarily seriously ill, we just needed to refill a prescription or get a new prescription. We were able to do that by video chat or telephone, telemedicine. And this is something that might be sticking around.
You know, as I was preparing to do that story this week, Michael, I actually did a little drilling into the history of telemedicine. And in fact, there was actually the first phone call made for medical care was done more than 100 years ago. So this is not new in the sense that it's brand new now, but it took a long time because as many of the hospital leaders have told me, patients resisted it, physicians resisted it, payers resisted it. But then came this pandemic. I mean, there had been pockets of telemedicine, but this just blew it open. And people were already so comfortable ordering food and furniture online that calling a doc seemed the most logical step. And all of the systems are reporting thousandfold increases in telemedicine usage. So that is going to stay, especially since the federal government is now paying doctors comparably for telemedicine as for in-office visits, which was this biggest sticking point.
Oh, interesting.
And once that happened last March at the beginning of the pandemic, because the federal government understood that telemedicine was going to be the tool that will keep the community connected to their healthcare, they instituted that, and then all the private payers started falling in line that. So that was a big step forward.
And that certainly convenient as well for a lot of people, I imagine.
Convenient. And also, you know, especially for this mental health care crisis that we're all experiencing now, even if it's, you know, mild boredom to the most grievous disorders, telemedicine is a really important ingredient now for people, because if you don't feel like leaving the house, you can call your doc from your house and say, I don't feel like leaving the house. You can do therapy by Zoom. You can get prescriptions refilled over telemedicine. So it's kind of I think it's also going to change how we see medicine. We're going to see it more as something more like something we buy from Amazon than this whole institutional, you know, go to the office and have all this magical sign-in procedures. I think people are going to see it as a service they buy.
We're talking with Ann Saker from the Cincinnati Enquirer. You know, Ann, when you're driving down 471 South into Kentucky, you see the hospital that says St. Elizabeth on there. But some of us who've been around a while know that it used to say St. Luke. And that might be something that we see changing in places maybe around the country, is that the names on hospital buildings could be changing again?
It will probably be a very gradual buildup to that, and it will be hard to recognize at first. But consolidation and amalgamation and merger has been kind of the order of the business in healthcare for probably the last 5 to 10 years at least. And it took a pause through the pandemic. But I think we're going to see, probably because of the tremendous financial pressures that the hospitals have endured, a lot of hospitals were barely making their margins before this happened. And then they had to do this. Fortunately, the CARES Act money from the federal government buoyed a lot of them and got them, helped them able to care for these very sick patients, buy PPE at hyperinflated prices, pay the whopping amounts of overtime to their staff who were in the trenches with the patients. So the CEO of the Ohio Hospital Association says he expects that we're going to start seeing mergers and acquisitions rolling out of the pandemic.
And in our last minute together, Ann, it looks like hospital billing might be changing, which could be good for consumers.
I think it could be, it will marry on with this item we were talking about, telehealth, where if you can actually go to your hospital's website and look at the list of charges, in January, a federal rule that had been the subject of a fight in the courts for 2 years finally went into effect. And it requires hospitals to post billing charges for 300 services that they provide. They have to tell you the gross charge, the charge they place for cash payment, and the charge they negotiate with all of the payers, all the insurance companies. So they're going to post these, and they're hard to find, but they're going to post them, and you can search for a knee replacement or, you know, other sorts of treatment, and you might see that more reflected in your bill, and it's going to allow consumers to have it a little more power over how they spend their money in healthcare.
Ann Saker is a health reporter at the Cincinnati Enquirer. You can read her reporting at cincinnati.com. Ann, it's always such a pleasure to have you on. I look forward to running into you out in public sometime soon.
Amen to that, Michael. Thank you.
Have a great weekend. And all of you listening, we've made it to Friday, and your weekend is about to begin, too. We're so grateful that you spent so much of your week with us here at Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. This theme music was composed by Rob Fetters, and you can find more online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday.